Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Code and the Coding Coders Who Code It. I'm your host, Drew Bragg, and I'm joined today by Daniel Huss. Daniel, for those of you who do not know you, since this is your very first time being on a podcast, please introduce yourself.
Hey, Drew. I'm Daniel, and I am by day a senior software consultant at Testable. At night, you might see me as a refactoring enjoyer. My last career was as a chef, so I often cook with my wife for fun and hobbies. And I am from Calgary, Alberta.
Awesome. So for those of you who are new to the show, and especially for you, Dan, the way this is going to work is I'm going to ask you three questions. What are you working on? What blockers do you have? If you don't have a current blocker, it's totally okay to talk about a blocker you've recently had and how you went about solving it. And then the last question is, what's something cool, new, or interesting that you've learned or discovered? It doesn't have to be coding related, but as the title of the podcast may have given away, it can totally be related to code. So without further ado, what are you working on?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about how to answer this question. It's because I'm a consultant. I can't talk about specifics about client projects or anything like that I'm working on. Although I suppose that's not a whole lot different for folks who are working on internal proprietary software kind of thing. In this case, the reason we got connected was because you came to my talk at Rails Conference.
I did. And it was a wonderful talk. It was one of my favorites. To be fair, I don't do a lot of talks at conferences. I'm much more hallway track oriented. But given that I deal with a lot of legacy code at work, your talk definitely piqued my interest.
Yeah, thank you. And I really appreciated you and your feedback and just saying, hey, it was what you were expecting when you kind of came in based on the title, which means I did the dev clickbait really well.
You did.
And I have found that a lot of the projects I end up working on through my career so far have been older Rails applications, bigger legacy code bases. So the client I'm at right now is working on internalizing a really sizable application. There's a monolith at the center of it, but there's also some modular services around it. It's been very organic in its evolution over the 14 years or something that it's been around. So there's a lot of stuff under the sun from every era of Rails and Ruby that you can imagine. If it's been done in this language and framework, it's in this application. And that's been really interesting to really sink our teeth into. And then the other fun part is that the shop is not a Rails shop. So they have a lot of Python devs and a lot of really awesome people to work with. And the role that me and my fellow testablers are bringing here is to smooth over those idiosyncrasies and older pieces of Rails and do the, oh, this is how you do what you want in Rails. So it's been a lot of fun. And the reason I brought up the Rails conference talk is just that I have found myself landing in more and more of these legacy applications. It's really cool that we have a mature enough ecosystem around Rails and around Ruby that we can be working on applications that are over a decade old and have had how many thousands of developer hours on them.
Yeah. And I don't believe the conference videos will be out by the time this recording goes out. Once it is out, I will absolutely link it in the show notes. I think it's a wonderful talk and everyone should go to. When you said that I had gone in with a certain expectation and it wasn't met, that's not a negative thing. It was very good talk and it wasn't what I expected. And I think almost in a way that was sort of the point you were getting at is I think of legacy code in a certain way, my experiences with it, the emotions I have around it. And your talk kind of flipped it on its head of changing the way we think about legacy code. The end of legacy code is not here's how to refactor your way out of it, but how to stop thinking about it with some of those negative sentiments.
I think there's an undercurrent in some of the talks that I have consumed a lot of, the Sandy Metz talks and some of the other notables who have dove into how do we work technically with legacy code. And there's always this undercurrent of like, if we don't have to mess with that, don't touch it. Shove that in a corner and cover it in a blanket and ignore that class or that whole application if you can. And that's been really fascinating to me of there's the tinkerer in all of us, I think, that we come across a system and we want it to be really beautiful and intuitive and easy to understand. But sometimes it's not worth it. And there's a lot of business reasons for that. But sometimes those reasons are emotional driven. And a lot of the resources that we have on our teams are about how's our team morale? How engaged is everybody? How much fun is everybody having working on this? To some extent, that matters a lot to how successful is our business going to be. So I've had the joy of jumping around to seeing different organizations and being parts of very different teams and how they engage with those types of challenges and keep the morale going, sometimes faltering, but more often than not, I think I come across people who just want to own those things really well and sometimes just don't know quite the way to do it. So mindset can be really an awesome launching point to diving into those problems. You said you work with a lot with legacy code yourself too.
Yeah. Our application at work, I don't know precisely how old it is because before we were on Git, we were on SVN and the oldest Git commit is about a little over 14 years ago, but I know it existed before that. And the oldest commit is Rails 2.0, Ruby 1.8, which is a part of my job, especially revolving around doing our upgrade, involved getting into some of those places where, like you said, that the way to deal with the legacy code or the technical debt is like shove a blanket over it, ignore it. As long as it's working, no one cares. The problem is, as you start to upgrade, some of those things magically stop working. You have to go in there. And I learned a lot. My kind of go-to conference talk is a game show about Weird Ruby. And my first iteration of it, a lot of that code came straight from this code base because I would look at it and just go, I consider myself a decent Rubyist. Not great, but decent enough. And I don't even know how to Google that thing.
Right.
So there was a degree of weirdness there, but certainly a lot of fun. But I think it was a lot of that shove a blanket over it, pretend it doesn't exist until 14 years later, it breaks, and now someone has to go in there and touch it. And I'm like, there's got to be a better way. I understand from a business perspective, the idea of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But then I am a second career dev. My first career was as a mechanic. I also know very much that if you want your car to go 300,000 miles, you have to do routine maintenance to it. If you ignore it and wait until it breaks, you're going to have a bad day. You're going to break other things around it. You're going to cost yourself more money in the long run, things like that. And I think, especially as I get more and more experience in legacy code bases, that there's some parallel there, that maintenance is also a key component to keeping a successful application running in the long term.
Totally agree. There's a real interesting challenge there, though, where maybe it's an industry setup, maybe it's individual businesses, but the incentives aren't always aligned for the person who's making the decision to say, yeah, it's time to start putting some maintenance into this thing. That can be really painful if you're the first person on a team or in an organization, especially to say, here's the line in the sand that we're now going to change our behavior around. That can be really painful. Slows down some of your deliverables, or you just have developers that have to feel the pain of a lot of that legacy stuff. Though, to be fair, if it's so extensive, often the pain points are felt everywhere in the organization. But there's that inertia of, we haven't worked this way before. How do we start putting our fingers into this and start paying off some of that technical debt? And until you start seeing some of those early results that feel really good, they're like, oh, wow, we changed this whole thing, or we cut out this huge chunk of the application. We don't have to be stressed about changing anymore. Until you get that emotional feedback, I think, of satisfaction. Yes, I swept up the floor of the shop and put the tools away in the chest where they belong. It's hard to have the faith and the vision and in we're going the right way.
It's incredibly hard to have that faith. It's incredibly hard if you're the one trying to give the team that faith to structure it in a way that's like essentially like, hey, just trust me. You kind of have to just, hey, trust me. Try and find some low-hanging fruit so that they can see like, hey, remember this class that no one wanted to touch because it was hard to read? Look at how much nicer it is now. Hey, remember when we had like this process going on that we couldn't understand? Well, if we take a couple of steps back and let Rails do its thing and follow the convention, we can remove that configuration, which simplifies our code, and we can get our same result with less codes easier to manage and understand. You just need to understand the Rails convention.
Yeah.
Which actually brings me to a question about some of your work, especially you said right now you're kind of working with a team, a lot of Python developers who aren't Rubyists and potentially don't know Rails, and they have a lot of different patterns in their code base. Is it pretty much the standard operating procedure for you or you at TestDouble to kind of say, hey, when we run into a situation where there's a lot of these different patterns, we kind of just go back to the Rails way?
I'd really hesitate to say there's one pathway.
Yeah, sure. I know it depends, but
right. That's, he says, yeah. Senior software consultant. Yeah. Yeah, no, it does depend, doesn't it? Like, I think one of the pragmatic things that I learned I worked at another consultancy from Calgary here called Pixeltree before I joined Testdouble. And even there, we were really focused on meeting our clients where they were at. And that's a core value of Testdouble. I don't think Pixeltree didn't quite phrase it the same way, but that was really the belief as well. So that was a natural transition into Testdouble as well. As we're working on different projects, you have to meet the code base and the team and the business where it is today. So it's very easy to say like, yes, let's come in and here's all the ways we should be doing things. Like I've seen this work really well over here, or this is the convention. We don't want to do configuration. The reality is, especially in bigger organizations, things are going in a certain direction and you can't flip it on a dime. If there's 100 developers working on a code base, you have to get 100 people buying into a new way of doing things and standardizing around something. So that can be a really process-driven initiative. It takes a while to get that buy-in. And it's a little bit of the belief thing we were saying, right? Of, hey, if we do it this way, we might resolve some of our own pain points or things might feel better. So there's definitely not one way. And then I think you said low-hanging fruit of the application is using like, hey, every different way of outputting errors. So let's pick one. Or we're using every single different way of making HTTP requests. Let's pick one and start pulling away those other pieces of it. But also part of it is that the system is so big that sometimes you just say, until we get back to it, it's going to stay how it was. Everything new, let's try to do this approach on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. It's certainly, I have not formally been a consultant in my career. I have worked at a company where occasionally I got to work with a different team or add an update or a feature to a different product or code base that I hadn't been, that wasn't my day-to-day. But for the most part, I've been a product engineer.
Yeah.
And something that I've learned and definitely am still learning is there's actually a fair amount of difference between being a product engineer and a consultant. Certainly, we both write Ruby and both write Rails and both have feelings on good code and whatnot. But like the approach that you take to projects and the approach that you take to considering something done or done right or done well differs slightly. Not because you're right and I'm wrong or vice versa, but because your purpose in that code base is different than mine. If you come onto my team, it's generally to help us get over a hump or to accomplish a goal, whereas I am in it for the long haul and I am trying to keep my code base and business afloat. That is all to say there's just some degree of difference, I think, at least in my experience, a good consultant creates that, yeah, here, it's good for the long term, but certainly I'm paying you to get it done, not necessarily paying you for the most beautiful, accurate code. So that balance seems like a very interesting challenge for a consultant.
It's an interesting dance, right? We think of consultants often as extra lift. Like, hey, we have this huge feature we want to do. We want to get over the line and we don't need this many devs to maintain it. So we don't want to expand our team to have long-term this many people, but some extra help. I think that's been something that took up a lot of my conversation time at Rails conference in the hallway track was talking to product engineers. And sometimes I get the little bit of the grass is greener to feel like getting to stay at one place and be with one code base, you start getting such a deep knowledge of what does this thing do? What's our problem domain and who are our users and why does this thing matter? And there's that focus on longevity. It matters to you if work you do today is painful in 6 months. And a lot of contractors and offshore teams or nearshore teams or people that you're bringing in temporarily aren't incentivized in that same way. They can leave in 6 months when they've finished their deliverables or their Jira tickets or however you break down the project and say, yep, cool, that was great. We got paid, you got your thing, we're all happy here. So maybe it's kind of weird then that I am thinking so much about legacy code and liking the process of jumping between projects so much when I also do really care deeply about how does this thing live in the long term? How does it feel for developers in a year or 2 years from now when my time at whatever project is likely going to be 6 months or less? It's interesting to balance those two things.
I mean, if I may be so bold as to say, I think that's what maybe makes a great consultant, or at least makes a type of consultant that I would want to work with, is someone who doesn't leave after 6 months. Obviously leaves after 6 months, but when they're gone, their code doesn't cause me pain. I'm happy about the code that they left me with. So I appreciate that at the very least, for whatever that's worth.
Hey, if we can, me or Testdouble or any consultancy can work themselves out of a job, I think that's the right mindset. If you don't need anything from me by the time I'm gone and you have it totally under control or your team processes are really smooth, you've got great morale about your legacy code that you're inheriting, then I've done my job and I can leave, or maybe we can work together on a deeper or different type of problem.
Is that a thing that happens with a degree of frequency at Testdouble, where you'll work on a project, potentially leave for a little bit, and then actually go back because they say, hey, you guys did great last time, let's bring you back for X?
I would say that happens. I wouldn't say it's the most common approach. I think what happens more is we work with a client, we come in and do work with them, maybe we meet those goals and that project ends and we say our farewells and everything is good, everyone's happy. Usually what happens is it's the people that we worked with who maybe they go to another company or they move to another department and they have a new problem now, or they've maybe progressed in their career, they're an engineering manager now or something like that. We get a lot of work from that past experience of, hey, I got to work with these guys or those gals from Testdouble and I want to have that experience again. We have some clients that we have worked with and the project's gone really well. We did some of that kind of surge capacity type thing. And then we step back and then months or a year or longer later, we'll be able to rekindle that. So I think that's where those long-term relationships come into play, right? If I left you code that in 6 months really hurt, there's no way you're ever going to hire me again or refer me to your friend who was having a similar problem or talk at Rails conference. And then after you would not invite me onto your podcast, I don't think. So I have the advantage of you came to my talk and it was good and I haven't written code for you yet. So maybe the rubber will hit the road one day on that one.
Just as a quick revisit to RailsConf, because now I'm all excited about RailsConf again. Are you more of a hallway track or a talk attendee?
So that was my first Rails conference.
Really?
Yeah. It was a ton of fun. I really enjoyed it. I know some folks and the guys were talking on the recap podcast. It felt a little smaller this year and I could totally see that. The time I had was awesome. I think I split it pretty evenly between hallway conversations and seeing some of my fellow Testdoublers talk. Landon gave an awesome talk about like intro machine learning, and Ali gave a really awesome one about zero downtime Rails upgrades, which immediately impacted like my work the next week kind of thing. So it's been super cool getting to see so many of the talks and then go and talk about them in the hallway or make those connections. And I had so many conversations with product devs and product engineers, which that's not my normal. So we could really drill into a little bit of a, like, what are the differences between these? Makes me get the FOMO maybe a little bit for getting to put roots down in one place and stay. But I don't think my ADHD would allow me to stay longer than 6 months and be really thoroughly enjoying a project unless there's lots of day-to-day change. It really works for me to go into a new project and start kind of from scratch and put the pieces together. And
yeah, that's wild. That was your first RailsConf and you opted to speak as your first RailsConf. That is ballsy, let me tell you. I have spoken at 3 conferences now and I'm still terrified and deal with so much like, oh, why did I do this? I should never do this. I should have just come to this and focused on enjoying myself. So kudos to you for going, yeah, I'll go to RailsConf for the first time. Let me do a talk.
I think, honestly, it was a little bit of, I'll say bad luck. It was not bad luck. I thought, you know what? The request for papers is out. Why don't I do one for the experience of submitting a talk proposal? And then when I actually want to give a talk, I'll know how to do the proposal so that I'm ready for that piece of it. And then they were like, hey, we want you to come talk. So
that's awesome.
It just, yeah, definitely was very surprising for that to work out that way. My wife rolled her eyes and was like, yes, of course I knew that was going to be the way that worked out. But had a ton of support on the proposal and then on actually drafting the talk as well. And
that's awesome.
But I think you have given the game show talk a few times, right? Like it's kind of evolved over time. Was that absolutely first time that you did it really terrifying? Because like, hey, I don't know any of this. You've practiced and rehearsed, but did you know that it was going to come out well? Has it refined over time?
It has very much refined over time. The very first time I gave it, I had a huge advantage in that the talk was not recorded and it was a very small conference. It was at Sin City Ruby, which I think there might have been 50 attendees at. Great. Lovely, awesome. Beautiful conference. I mean, you're in Vegas, first and foremost. That's a lot of fun. It's small, so it's intimate. So if you're a fan of like developing good connections, the small conferences are where it's at. You just have much more meaningful interactions with folks. And then knowing that it's not recorded, I'm like, okay, worst case scenario, if this goes terribly, it's just 50 people who are just like, wow, that guy sucks at giving a talk. He should retire now. Luckily for me, the exact opposite happened. Everyone thought it was great. Lots of great feedback. I was able to refine it, give it at RubyConf, and it went over even better. And I took everything that I had tweaked it further, changed every single question. It was a completely new game show for RailsConf. The nerves did not go away at all.
But they never do.
It's such a fun talk to give because the audience has so much fun. There's something about just knowing like, hey, good job for me is like the audience went, that was a lot of fun. Really enjoy it. And it makes the nerves totally worth it.
I did a dinner theater, a local community dinner theater thing like a number of years ago. And lesson I took from that, I think we ended up doing 4 or 5 shows of it. And the nerves never went away at the start of it. I was nervous every time before going out on stage. Even the last one, I had thought maybe naively that, yeah, I've rehearsed this ton and I've done 4 performances of this. The 5th one, I'll be totally calm, cool, collected. And that just is not the case. Those anticipation nerves are always there. So I don't know if anyone's listening and is thinking about giving a talk and it's like, how do I start? Or like, I'm not brave enough to get up to a crowd. Please come find me. And I would love to talk to you about how to do that, how to put that together. Some of the things I've learned about public speaking. My degree is in communications and media. So the background I come from is not technical for sure. And I've been leaning on those skills a lot in my career, not just at Rails Conference, but in my day-to-day work and communicating with peers and colleagues, and love to share as much of that knowledge as anybody wants to talk about.
Absolutely. And ditto here too. Anytime anyone has any questions, feel free to reach out to either one of us because I think it's incredibly valuable to get different speakers. I'm always going to submit the game show because I think it's fun. I enjoy giving it. The audience has a blast, but I think that having almost a revolving door of different folks coming in and sharing their experiences is incredibly valuable for the community. So if you're thinking about doing a talk at any conference, small, medium, large, you should, number one, should absolutely do it. And if you need any help, reach out to one of us and we'll help you along the way. So is it safe to assume that you will be submitting talks for future conferences?
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to focus more maybe on some of the technical pieces, give a very technically focused talk. The one that I gave, I'm so excited to share it and talk with more people about it. The one I gave was very technically light. There were a couple of code examples, but it was mostly about people and emotions and that kind of thing, which is important to the work that we're doing. But I was floored by the quality and the depth of some of the technical talks and how much I took out of them and sharing problems and sharing insight into like, hey, this was a huge thing that we dealt with and here was our approach. Here's how we worked through it. Here were some of the big pitfalls along the way. That's really cool stuff to share. And I definitely want to tap more into some of those pieces going forward.
I think that there is room for both types of talks. There are room for hybrids of being very technical, but also keeping the humanity about it. There's so many different types of talks that have places at so many different conferences. I'm really always happy when I go to a conference and I see a whole bunch of new topics, whatever they are.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
So that brings us to our next question of, as a consultant, he must have some pretty cool blockers. What is one that you currently have? If you don't have a current one, that's totally fine. Talk about one that was the most fun or sticks out in your head.
One of my favorite examples of maybe some technical blockers was from a little earlier in my career when I still very much felt like a junior. Not to say that I don't feel like a junior developer often coming into new people's code bases and learning new domains. That is a pretty regular feeling, I'd say. There was an application we were working on that had decided to abstract out all of the inputs for the HTML for their forms. All of the inputs should just be one React component. And then that input component became 500 some lines of code and nested conditionals and all sorts of other parameters being put in there. So that one wasn't something that I got unblocked on by myself. Certainly, I was the one continuing to hit my head on that. And our senior and team lead came in and said, oh, okay, we're going to put some blankets over these parts of it. I'm going to refactor out, lean on some refactoring tools, divide it up a little bit to get to what's in the middle and what we need to understand more for our use case today. And then we can ignore the rest of it for as long as we can. We don't have to fix the 1,000-line JavaScript file. I talk about that example a lot because it just solidified for me how powerful talking through what your problem is with somebody else can be. Hey, we keep hitting this roadblock. It's like really hard to work on this thing or use this input. We want to stick to the team convention, but this thing sucks. How can we work on that? And having somebody come in who uses like a JetBrains IDE and leans on those refactoring tools. I was still a VS Code user at the time. No shade. I have been sold the JetBrains way of doing things and the tools are super powerful. So I pay for them now and I love them very much. But having really effective tools alongside talking through a problem with somebody else who has a different perspective or more experience, a lot of it ended up being, hey, we can focus on this like two or three functions in here and refactor those a little bit and improve those. We could ignore a lot of the rest of the stuff, becoming a lot easier to work without breaking the thing that was used all over the code base and had its fingers deep into every part of the application. That was a good one that I've taken with me.
It sounds like a good one.
I think the big one when you work in old Rails code bases is that you can kind of see just like a little bit of everything everywhere you go. And maybe a client example would be, or if you're not somebody who does testing, it's kind of like, oh, why would we do that? And then I think maybe early in the adoption of test-driven development or belief in, hey, we should have continuous integration and that type of testing should be part of our regular workflow in our application. Early on, that feels really good. And then it can also lead to, hey, we've forgotten that these tests are also a liability. And this is also code that we have to take care of and maintain, especially if it was written in a way that the test can be fragile or not super well established. So we start seeing some really bulky test suites that start taking 30, 40 hour, multiple hours to work through. And the client I'm at now inheriting this code base also is inheriting like a really unwieldy test suite. So we've had a lot of problems around like, hey, how do we get CI/CD set up in a way that gives us confidence? That's what our tests are for, is giving us confidence about what does this application do when the team is really unconfident in the territory. It's new language, new framework. They understand the domain really well, which is awesome, but they're still learning how does the domain play out in this application? And how do we lean on the test suite in a way that gives us confidence without it blocking progress on everything else that we need to do? If this thing takes hours to run on a single thread, then what can we do to increase our feedback and make our development cycles go faster? So I wish I had a really like satisfying conclusion for you in this conversation that I can say, yes, here's exactly what we did. We've done some stuff that said like, okay, we'll pair out a really skinny set of tag tests that are like the most critical. And we can run that on every push on your branch. We won't run the bulky test suite until you've put the PR together. There's some, you know, there's work around like batching pull requests and that kind of thing. But I think for me, the blocker now, and we're still working through it, is how do you work with a really legacy test suite that is bulky and doesn't give us confidence? Maybe it's got some flake to it. Like there's tests that fail inconsistently, aren't well-written, they're long, take a long time to run. And the emotional component of it really plays in where they just want to make small change. I haven't changed anything. It's just a small refactor. I don't need to wait for the hour to run this test suite. I know that this is simple. How do we clear those out of the way as much as we can so that you get into those tight feedback loops and it feels good to work on the code, like something greenfield?
Yeah, test suites are almost a completely different animal than your day-to-day code. There's so much more allowance for duplication. And actually, I, at least in my experience, have found that like duplication in test code is actually more helpful as the code that it's testing changes and evolves, being able to adjust a single test and not have it blow up the quote unquote global state. It's such a different animal. It's such a different domain space that it's one of those, I thought I knew how to write tests coming out of the coding bootcamp I went to because we did TDD. And then like 6 months into a project, I'm like, actually, I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's a completely different way of learning. There's different techniques and principles and patterns that you apply in a test environment, and it makes it an interesting challenge in addition to all the CI stuff that you just brought up.
Writing tests, and the reason I like TDD so much is because it changes the way that you structure your code, and the code that you put out in the end is easily testable if you're testing it first. I think there's a lot of people I've met that are like, oh, writing tests is so boring and it sucks. Like, well, you didn't write them first, did you? You're trying to test the thing after it's already built. I find that unfun too. Like, I don't have the patience for doing that. Although I will say maybe some of the most fun I've had is, hey, this whole code base is untested. What do we do? Let's start putting some harnesses around it. Let's start putting pieces together. Yeah, some like legacy applications that have 10 years of development and no tests. That's like the Wild West, and it's a good time if you have a good team that's ready to jump in and sink their teeth into it.
How do you even approach something like that? We have very low or non-existent test coverage. We have over a decade old application that's huge and unwieldy, and we need a test suite as we upgrade it. Like, how do you even go and say, like, here's where we start? Is it system tests, unit tests, integrations, like buzzwords galore, pick one? But what would be the, without saying it depends, don't say it depends, because I know it depends, but like as a general gist, what's a good starting place?
No, it doesn't depend. I think trying to start with like integration tests is not the way. There's too much unknown in any legacy code base. Like, if there's no documentation and no tests, you've had attrition at your company that has meant you've lost knowledge about the bulk of what happens in your code. Maybe not the bulk, but there's going to be parts of it. There's just no knowledge around how does this thing work. There's a cool blog post. I'll have to find it so you can put it in the show notes about how code bases are like a garden that the first gardeners have the vision and understand, like, I've planted these things and here's how it's going to grow and where it's going to go towards. And if the second generation of people that come in don't get ingratiated into that mindset and turned into like kind of a first tier of gardener who understand the same vision, doesn't matter how much documentation or testing you have, you're going to lose too much knowledge. And if there's a break in that ingratiation process, then you'll lose a lot of what happens in this code base and you'll have to rewrite things. You'll have to start from scratch because nobody understands. The mind palace has crumbled and nobody gets what's going on in this thing. So when you're coming at something totally from scratch and trying to just put the pieces together, I don't think you can ever get enough context at the start to say, yes, I will totally put some integration tests around this. There's just too many pieces. You don't know where the traps are or the fragility is. And you can write some tests that really paint you into a corner of, wow, we did these and they're garbage now. Whereas I think if you start with the unit testing approach and only on things that you're changing, you don't go unit test stuff that you're not working on. You only do tests for stuff you want to change or bugs you want to fix. And over time, you start mapping out bigger pieces of the domain. You've got more tests around, like, oh, we have this one model, this massive user model, and there's no tests at the start. But it doesn't take long, like maybe 3 months, and you'll start feeling, oh, actually, we've kind of tested out 60% of this thing, or like the bulk of what flows through this. So you can then see, oh, this user model file might be 3,000 lines long, but there's only really 500 lines of it are used a lot and matter a lot. And the rest of it, we can kind of ignore some more. So yeah, it's that process of starting to wrap things that you're working on. And then over time, you'll start seeing, oh, hey, okay, the test suite's now getting a little bulkier, unhinged. Let's repivot back. And do we have enough safety now? Do we have enough of a test harness that we could do some refactoring in a way that brings this architecture more towards, not to the best place, but just move it in a step towards somewhere that maybe we'd like this to go in the future? So I think we talked about the tinkering a little bit, and there's that mindset of wanting everything to be perfect. Sweeping up as you go, and doesn't have to go from the organic spaghetti thing that came out of 10 years of just kind of slowly cobbling together. You can start by like breaking dependencies and just like moving it a little bit towards a better future. You don't even have to know what the better future is necessarily. So I think underneath what I'm saying is there's a process that has to happen at the start of we need to explore what this thing is because none of us really understand it. And we don't have any confidence in how this thing works. So as you start staking out your trails and saying, okay, these are the pieces of the garden that we have now mapped out a little bit and understand, that gives you more confidence to then go in and do bigger things like refactoring a model or putting two pieces together, or making those models interact in a better way. That opens the door to stuff like integration testing as a feature becomes more understood and complete picture again. I'm proud of myself. I didn't give you a depends.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that's also an easy one to give a depends answer for because in some ways it does, but I liked your answer and I'm interested to read the blog post because I think that idea of it being a garden and it growing is a good one and I'd love to read that. That is certainly a cool thing to share and I can't wait to put in the show notes, but now you don't get to use it for the last question. Which is, what is something cool, new, or interesting that you've recently learned or discovered that you want to share?
This is a tail end to my last answer, but what's a blocker? And then we'll go into this last question.
Yeah, let's go.
When you're working on big legacy code all the time, where you're working on things that are really abstracted and are hard to work on, it can be a little demotivating and sometimes doesn't feel super exciting.
Agreed.
So finding stuff that sparks that joy of like, yes, I love tinkering on stuff, or I love trying new things, or whatever it takes to spark that thing that made you love programming in the first place, like lean into that and make time for that. Carve out a little bit of time after your lunch break or as part of like, if you have time for growth at your company, like find it on stuff that you love. So right now I'm playing with a little thing called Dragon Ruby Toolkit, nice. Which is, you've heard of, you're familiar.
I have heard of, I'm excited about how much it has been talked about recently because it is such a cool project and I'm excited to hear your takeaways.
Yeah. It's Ruby at its best, and I am not a game developer, nor do I ever want to become one. I don't have nearly enough math skills. That's my biggest takeaway, is that there's a lot of math that goes on when you're making games, and that's really cool. I am not good at that, but it's been a lot of fun to just say like, hey, I have this mobile game on my phone. I love that. I'm just going to copy that. I'm not going to make a new game. I'm not going to invent my own thing. I'm just going to see what it takes to recreate that. And the joy that I've been getting and the satisfaction I've been getting out of it is that like, I'm not doing any unit testing. My unit testing is I'm going to go and like play the game now and see what happens when I click stuff and what can I break. And it's so obvious what your next things are. At least I've been finding that, because when you're starting from a blank slate and you have the finished product in front of you of something you're trying to copy, you can very easily just say, oh, this works like that in the game. My game doesn't do that. How do I start solving that problem? And then it proliferates out to 6 or 7 different problems that involve math somewhere in there that I didn't realize it did, and calculating angles. And so that's been really fun though. Like, I don't do math in my normal job. Mm. Maybe I shouldn't say that entirely. There is math involved, especially if you work at like a fintech or something, but you're not doing geometry.
Right.
And so I think solving slightly different problems in a familiar enough way that getting to lean on Ruby, I don't have to learn Unity or some other game engine. I can stay where I'm comfortable. There's some APIs that I got to learn in this thing, but a lot of it's just object-oriented programming in Ruby. And the engine gets out of your way as much as possible to say, here's stuff that nobody should have to think about. Like, how big is the screen that this is rendering on? It's like, no, you just know that it's 1280 by 720 and it just works. You just don't think about some of those pieces. So kudos to the devs behind Dragon Ruby Toolkit. It's awesome. I will never release a game for anybody to play. That's for me to play on my own and have fun and spark my own joy so that I can go back to solving business domain problems.
Dragon Ruby is a great thing to have in the something cool, new, interesting. And I agree that there is a lot of joy that comes from doing something that's not your day-to-day programming. I would like to think at least that for a majority of us developers, we like problem solving. We like, as you said, tinkering. So I think getting to do that, but in just a pure, it's like when you're a kid and you build Lego sets and it's really fun to build the Lego sets, but yes, it's also really fun to rip them apart and turn into something that is completely 100% just your imagination running wild. There's so much that you learn from that. And I don't think that it's fair to say like, oh, it has nothing to do with my job. Well, I think some of the takeaways you take, some of the learning and growth that you experience by tinkering and playing and just having pure fun and joy with something improves your ability to do your job. I really do think that. Like, I think when like a company does a hackathon and they're like, well, should it be something work-related or should it be something completely not work-related? 100% not work-related. You relieve all the stress of the thing that you create at the end needing to go into production or be like this long-standing thing. Hey, I've seen hackathons yield really cool things that become full-blown products all on their own. But just that, let programmers do what they already enjoy doing. And then when they get back to work, they're refreshed and revitalized. They probably learned a ton. Yeah, I'm with you. I like that answer. That is a great answer.
I take your point, and maybe I said that this has nothing to do with my job, and your call out was good because now I'm thinking about it and the joy that I've gotten out of like, oh, I built like this little system for making the map or something in the game. And there's still 87% of the app does not work or the game is garbage. It's like, oh, but I really enjoyed building that. And now I want to focus on making that better. So nobody is going to stop me from doing that because this app is for only one person, me. And I'm having fun programming it, not playing it. So I will take the step to do this like whole rewrite or chop pieces out of it and reorganize it and re-architect it. And I have taken that with me to being braver about, hey, here's a thing that exists in this code base that I'm working on. Maybe I should chop more of this up. Maybe I should take a crack at re-architecting a little bit of this or exploring and having a little more freedom to play around with and allow some exploration of things that seem really solid in code bases that I've worked in. Sometimes I'm really hesitant to do that. And maybe part of that's the consulting piece of, I don't want to like re-architect it and then not have buy-in and then leave this thing that other people are like, what is this thing? How does this work? See, I think maybe in my own growth, I have some room to be a bit more confident in trying some stuff. And then at the end of it, we should always be ready to throw our code away anyway, right? If code is a liability, we always need to be throwing it away.
I throw away so much code. It's out of control. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on the Dragon Ruby piece, anyone who's listening going, oh, this sounds interesting. There have been a ton recently. I feel like it's bubbling up like crazy. Amir, who is, the brains creator, maintainer of Dragon Ruby, was recently on Remote Ruby. And what an episode. Like, that was a fantastic episode. He said some things that blew my mind about Dragon Ruby and his thoughts behind it. I will link that episode in the show notes. If anyone listening has not listened to that episode, please go listen to it. It's fantastic. And then Chris from the Rubber Duck Dev Show does a mostly weekly stream where he's live coding a little game using Dragon Ruby. And that is a very fun time too, to kind of just see not just someone figure it out live, but also when you're, it's almost like a one-sided pairing. You're just kind of hearing someone think out loud. And that's a lot of fun too. So lots of cool Dragon Ruby stuff going on. So I'm pretty excited about that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. The license for it is pretty inexpensive. And like you said, the guys that are behind it have put a lot of intent and effort into it. Pick that up, play around with it, have a good time. There's some good dudes. And I hope they keep doing an awesome job of building this really fun tool that I've gotten a lot out of.
Yeah, 100%. And I definitely love your approach of just like, hey, I'm going to do this thing, not a game dev, not releasing this as a game. It's just fun. Like, that is a completely valid way of doing things and something I encourage people, including myself. I'm going to try and take my own advice and your advice, as it were, to do. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I don't know. Maybe I'll get your take on this one. Something that I struggle with a lot is like picking one fun thing to do. So not necessarily because I'm like overflowing with amazing creative ideas or, but I find it's like, oh, I'll kind of get like past like the first couple steps of it. And then it gets hard. And then it's like a little less fun unless you really commit to it. So there's been like, I've done a Rails new on a, like, especially a lot of ChatGPT related stuff because it's so popular. Everyone's like, yeah, we got to learn how to do this thing. And it's a little bit like, is it FOMO that's making me like, yeah, I should lean into this thing? Or is it actually fun? I love using the chat. It's great. That's a cool pairing activity. You can rubber duck with a ChatGPT pretty well. But then I like get to like, oh, maybe I should do a cool, like, I have this tablet that I write all my notes in and it does like text detection for my writing. Maybe I could like use a chatbot that improves because my handwriting sucks. Maybe it can parse through that and make a better summary of like the notes that I wrote from the week or something. And then I get like 20 minutes into it and I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm never touching that project again, which I feel like is a pretty common thing. People pick up something and then put it away. I don't know what else I want to say about that, except that I do it a lot. And there are a lot of started games that have like three sprites in it that do a little thing. And then I've just put it on the shelf and never touched it again. How many side projects are in your junk drawer?
Oh, gosh. Like my physical junk drawer or my coding related? I like the coding related junk drawer because Rails new, play around with it. Maybe you learned something, maybe you didn't. If it goes away, that's fine. The worst is when you have a junk drawer full of like, I don't know how many times I've been like, I'm going to learn how to do Arduino boards or like the e-ink things or the Raspberry Pis. And I'm like, I can open a drawer and I'm just like, there are so many boards in here. I have spent way too much money. Boards? On stuff that so much money has been wasted on, and I feel so bad because I refuse to get rid of them because I don't want to create more junk, but and they're perfectly good boards, but
yeah,
it's just not going to happen. I hear you, and I wish that I had a good answer for you, but I, unfortunately, like you, do the same exact thing. I also have a tablet that I write on and does the text to conversion, and I'm like, I bet I could do something cool with that. It's not going to happen. I also have atrocious handwriting and it would be great to like build something to improve it, especially if I'm like jotting down pseudocode, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to like, here's some pseudocode that I hand wrote ChatGPT, turn it into real code.
I love that.
It's not going to happen. Take the idea, take it, because I'm not going to do anything with it. I'm just going to think a lot about it. Maybe I'll do a Rails new. And then I'm like you, same way. The moment it becomes hard and I'm not immediately good at it, it's like, on to the next thing.
My instant gratification is over. We're done.
Yeah, here. Right? Right. I think that is some of it to a degree. It's just you're looking for dopamine. You're looking for a chemical in the brain and you get it by... Look at how fast I went from a blank screen to all of this cool stuff. So the only times I've been even remotely successful at keeping one of those little projects going for any meaningful amount of time is when I am pretty diligent about making sure that I can get that instant gratification on everything that I do. So like, just, okay, fuck it. We're going to a whole new page or we're going to incorporate a whole new thing. This thing's going to grow. Because it's my project, I can do whatever I want, which is perfectly fine. But yeah, being able to structuring anything where it's like, I'm getting some gratification, I'm getting some of that dopamine every time I play with it, keeps me coming back. But the moment I lose it, it's done. Time for the next thing, unfortunately. But yeah.
All right. So we're coining it today. DDD, dopamine-driven development.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
I'm writing that
down. I think that, you know what? I like TDD because it gives me that. And so... I can make things fun that aren't fun, but it's really hard when I stop testing and I'm like, yeah, it's no, we're free now. We can do whatever we want. No, yeah. I'm lost. Where's my dopamine?
I'm sure there's a listener out there that has cracked this whole problem. And if you're that listener, please reach out and let us know. Because one, I would love to have you on the show to pick your brain about it. And two, I know lots of people in Daniel's exact situation where everyone will benefit from it. So come on the show and let's talk about how to trick our brains into sticking with our side projects for more than a few lines of code. Well, it has been awesome to have you on. I am glad that I was able to give you the opportunity to do your first podcast. It's exciting to hear that you gave your first RailsConf talk and hopefully the first of many. And same with the podcast. There's so many great Ruby podcasts out there. Hopefully you will get on a few more and be able to talk about even more cool stuff.
Thanks for the invite, Drew. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, glad that you accepted said invite. Where can people find you on the internet?
There's a Daniel Huss who is a famous footballer who is not me. So I often go by Daniel-N-Huss. That's where you find me on GitHub. Sometimes it's underscores. You can also find me on the Testable blog. I've done a little bit of writing there. If you're interested in... What is the last thing I did? Like Tailwind form builders with Rails. There's a cool series of posts there. And I'm on the Ruby social Mastodon. Those are the places. And I will look forward to chatting with all of you later.
Yeah, I will include all of that into the show notes. And thank you again for coming on. This was a great chat.
Yeah, right back at you.
I'll see you all in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.